welcome to That Triathlon Show, the podcast presented by Scientific Triathlon and hosted by me, Michael Eriksson. And I'm joined once again by Jack Hutchins for today's episode, which is the final episode in our triathlon-based training series. And the topics for today's episode will be strength training, nutrition slash diet, and testing. And we will finish off with a listener Q&A. So welcome back to the show, Jack. How are you doing?
Thanks for having me, Michael. Yeah, no, I'm okay. I've been better. I unfortunately had a bit of a collision since our last podcast with a car, where I was just down an easy ride. Car pulled out last second from a side road and kind of stopped dead on the side of the road. So I'm suffering a bit with an injury there. But yeah, other than that, I'm happy to be back into a routine post-Christmas and excited to chat today. How are you doing?
Yeah, I'm good. We actually meant to record this episode. I think it must have been almost 3 weeks ago, perhaps. But I was just sick like a dog for 3 weeks and I literally lost my voice there, which is why we had to postpone. And then Christmas and New Year's came and your crash. So this has been a bit postponed. I'm good now. I definitely had a difficult period there with the illness before Christmas. But however, I would still take that ahead of a bike crash, even though it could be worse, of course, no broken bones. So that's good. How do you deal with a crash like that where you're physically suffering a bit, even though, again, it could have been more serious, but that it does affect your training and I guess mentally, or that's what I feel in a situation like that, at least, like you mentally, you just want to get out there, but you can't quite train. Well, you definitely can't train normally yet. Well, how do you try to manage that?
Yeah, I mean, I've been trying to think, how can I draw a positive from it and maybe shift focus and, but ultimately it just sucks really to a certain extent. And you kind of just have to accept it. I'm just kind of now in that acceptance period where I think training is suffering. Initially you're thinking, oh, it's just going to be a week and then I'm going to be able to get back to it, but now it's coming up to 2.5 weeks or so, and it's still pretty bad. So I'm having to just kind of accept that this is how it's going to be and do what I can when things get back to normal, I guess. The priority always needs to be on recovery, because it's tempting to go and try and do as much as I can in order to maintain form, but ultimately it's just going to have an impact and delay that recovery. So I don't know if you ever had a chest injury, but it's not a fracture, but I think there's some bone bruising over the ribs injury there, and it's a really slow one in terms of recovery. So it's frustrating. And but it is what it is, really, I think. And that's okay.
Yeah. I'm pretty similar, in a similar situation, because I was 3 weeks that I actually didn't train, or maybe I did a couple of super easy rides on the trainer. And then I realized that even that was too much. So you could say 3 weeks without any training. And then I got back into my running and obviously very unfit. But what was worse was that I didn't even do any strength training during the time off. And for me, for my hamstrings, they need that consistent stimulus of deadlifts or they will get injured. So I basically got back and immediately my hamstrings started complaining. And I've been able to run, but I've been feeling the hamstrings so much that I haven't been able to do any intensity since in the last 2 weeks since I came back running. And I've been now doing the strength training, of course, so I'm getting to the point where the hamstrings are complaining less and less, and I'm hopeful that this week will be the week that I get back to do some intensity as well. But yeah, that's been a bit of a mental challenge as well, that I was off for so long and then I come back, and then immediately on coming back, there's this kind of semi-injury that prevents me from doing the training the way I would like to do it. But yeah, I think it's the same as you said, you have to get to an acceptance phase, and then you have to basically be process focused of thinking not about where you were or what could have been, but about what you're doing now and what is the best thing to do going forward. At the end of the day, everybody at some point will have setbacks like this, and I think that the the people that deal with setbacks well, they tend to develop better in the long term as well, because you can easily let something like that rob your motivation and, yeah, I don't know, let it frustrate you so much that it impacts the quality of your training when you get back. So that's I guess what I'm trying to do, at least, to not think about that so much, just see that a fresh start almost.
Oh man, yeah, when it rains it pours, right? With the hamstring there. But I guess that's a nice segue onto to the strength training as well, right? You gotta,
yes.
For a lot of people that's it's so important to just maintain something specific to what kind of injury types or weakness that they have. Yeah, sure. Should we get into strength training?
Let's get into that. Yeah, I can start with that, and that's absolutely the first thing I think about, at least from an individual coaching perspective. When coaching athletes, is there a certain propensity for injuries that needs to be managed with strength training? Because I think that for me, 90% of athletes that have some kind of chronic injury that needs management, it's strength training is what resolves the issue. There are some other things, but mainly it's strength training. I think a lot of athletes believe that it's more about stretching or mobility, that sort of thing, and I think it's often misattributed when it really is strengthening that is required, many of that types of injuries. So that's, I guess, the first thing that I look at as a coach is, does the athlete have a particular need to strengthen a particular muscle groups consistently? And then that's obviously something you need to do. But other than that, I mean, a main thing for me with strength training, and remembering or reminding the listeners here that this is not an episode about strength training in isolation or nutrition in isolation. It's in the context of the base training phase, the winter training in the Northern Hemisphere. I'm generally a believer of not changing the strength training too much throughout the, or not changing the load or the focus that is put on strength training throughout the season. I think that doing a lot of strength training in winter and then kind of stopping or doing a lot less in your in-season period in summer when you're racing, I don't really believe that works so well. So I try to find for each athlete anything from zero strength training to maybe up to 3 times a week in rare cases, but 1 to 2 times being the more normal, finding whatever frequency and level of focus, level of effort going into strength training that is necessary and beneficial for that athlete, and doing it year round. It doesn't mean that there isn't periodization. There is definitely some periodization, and there's adaptations done around racing. So you wouldn't do, you know, a heavy lifting session in race week, but in general, yeah, I don't do something like 2 or 3 times of strength training per week during the winter to go to 1 or 0 during summer. That's not something I believe in. It's more like twice a week consistently throughout the year, with the exception of race week, and that's generally how I work. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, I'd go back to what you said about if there's a specific weakness or injury risk with that athlete, and the strength that is required to maintain or improve that and around that kind of area, that's a non-negotiable. That would be there throughout the year, but I probably would have a little bit more periodization over the year when we're talking about the strength work on top of that. So in the base period, I probably would put more of an emphasis in it, especially in the early in the base phase, and I would drop it back a little bit during the more intensive periods if we're doing a VO2 max block, or yeah, even as we approach the kind of build phase. And yeah, and then I would even drop completely during the competition phase in some instances. That would be typical. Obviously, there's definitely, yeah, kind of variation there to the individual. But I mean, and I would also be reluctant to just prescribe 1 strength session a week. I just feel like the soreness that you get from doing the strength work once a week without having the second to back it up, it's you kind of need a second touch point there. So I would probably say 2 times is the minimum, and I'd rather even just keep them quite short, just so we're getting the kind of key movement patterns and exercises in there, rather than having one massive kind of hour long gym session per week. Because I think for me, the priority as well is not to take away from swim, bike and run. So when, and this not only goes to just having the one per week, but also the timing of those strength sessions, I always want to make sure that we maximize the recovery from the one session to the next swim, bike, run kind of key workout. You can obviously ride or kind of train easy, but if you've got any intensity, then I want to make sure that gym work is not going to be in the body there and is not going to have a negative impact on that. So typically I like to do strength work even on the same day as an intensive workout after the workout, or if not the day after, and then you can then have a couple of recovery days before the next intensive day. I guess the caveat or the exception there would be plyometrics, which is, and anything I guess more neuromuscular or explosive, where I like the athlete to be more fresh, and it actually works well there doing them before run workouts as kind of an activation type session. Yeah. Do you have any thoughts there, or
I think a lot of those things resonate with me. I also agree that one gym session per week is something that I would very rarely do. I am reluctant to do it, although it has happened, but I think twice a week is the sweet spot for athletes for most athletes. Although I should say it does depend a bit on time availability, because for some athletes with low time availability, if they don't really like to do strength training and they don't have a problem with, you know, injury prevention or something like that, that's when I would maybe do zero strength training. So I'm not, I guess I'm not dogmatic about everybody has to do strength training. There are definitely other, especially from a triathlon performance perspective, when you're getting like into your 40s and especially 50s, then you also need to consider maybe the health aspect of things, which is a different question altogether, and that might lead you to still do some strength training even if you don't need it for triathlon performance, and even if it's not the trade-off of exchanging swim, bike and run for strength training isn't worth it from a triathlon performance, but it might be worth it from the perspective of general health. But yeah, I mean, I think all of those other points that you said, I'm kind of similar. I guess I do generally place strength training the same way that you described, but I have found as well that a lot of triathletes are quite slow twitch dominant, and once you have built up a bit of a period of consistency in strength training, they're not really able to lift hard enough or high enough weights for the strength training to really negatively impact an intense session the next day. So I think I'm less hung up on that these days than maybe I used to be. And even though that's maybe my default my pattern, it's not something that I'm too bothered by if I have to prescribe strength training the day before an intense session for most athletes. But there are definitely exceptions, especially athletes that are quite strong and powerful and are actually able to lift high weights. And yeah, then I would be more careful and pay a bit more attention to that. Another thing that I think is interesting to discuss here is what sort of exercises to do and if that's different between the base training phase and in season. So, well, I have some thoughts on that, but maybe do you want to start and talk about how you periodize that, the types of exercises, the type of strength training that you do?
Yeah. I mean, as I said, the periodization for me more comes from the load rather than the exercise type. There is definitely a bit of a variation there. I guess in the early base phase, I would typically lean more towards kind of a single side unilateral type exercises. They can, when basically there's not as much conditioning there, so the load, you can't load up as much as if you're doing single side stuff, which is generally a good thing when the condition is not there. Say if we were to go and throw in some super heavy back squats or something, then you're going to be super sore from that. So we want to keep the load low and sometimes doing some more single sided stuff where there's a more of a stability focus it works well. And then as we kind of build up that strength, we could progress to the more classic compound exercises where we're really focusing on lifting heavy. And then from there, maybe towards the back end of the base phase, I would look to adding some a bit more explosive work. So either accelerating through the lift or adding some more kind of like, so vertical jump type stuff, box jump, some more plyometric type work, I guess, towards the back end of the base phase. Do you, I mean, with you saying that you keep things very similar throughout the year, do you not have quite as much periodization there in terms of the type that you're just cycling through?
There's a little bit of periodization. There's not too much and the main reason there, I think, is that when you're doing strength training, maybe twice a week, you do 45 minutes. That's kind of, I guess, the 30 to 50 minutes, I would say, is the average that my athletes would be doing. Then we're simply working so far from our capacity that I think just that consistency of just doing it is the main. You don't need to overthink it, basically, with periodization. Mm. But there is some periodization, though. So it's interesting because I would kind of do it the opposite way that you said, with start with bilateral lifting. But I would, indeed, when you get into the lifting after a season break, perhaps, especially if you have taken a break from strength training, build up the load. So basically, my guideline for athletes would be that you can have some soreness after strength training, but you shouldn't let the soreness be so big that it really negatively impacts your ability to swim, bike, and run. And then you need to basically bring down the weights, and we have to progress from there. So my advice would always be let's say you're doing a back squat, as you said, as an example, just put on some relatively light weights the first session back, and then try to just add a little bit every session or every other session, and always checking in the day after, 2 days after, that you don't have too much soreness, that you're not getting negatively impacted in your swim, bike, and run. And then after a few weeks, usually it might take 2 to 4 weeks, depending on the athlete, to really get used to that. And then you can be doing those bilateral lifts with pretty much what we might call heavy weights, low rep, high weight, without getting too much soreness. Again, maybe with the exception of some more fast twitch dominant athletes. So that's generally the approach, building up a bit throughout the first weeks of the base training phase, mainly focusing on that, low weights, high reps, but building up low reps, high weights, building up the weights, and then doing that for a while throughout the base training phase, and then introducing more and more unilateral stuff when we get closer to the races, because the reason for doing that is that it's more specific to the movement patterns of cycling and running. So that's the reason that I approach it that way. But I do understand your point as well. And I think there's value to that approach too. And I think plyometrics definitely is something that I try to keep in year round, maybe a little bit more closer to the races, because again, I think that's quite a specific form of strength training for running. And core work is something that I also maintain. That's basically the thing that isn't really periodized. I like mix up exercises throughout the year, but there's some level of core work throughout the year, and that's pretty much it in terms of periodization. There's always some small tweaks, mixing up exercises. You wouldn't see me give the same exercise for one muscle group for 52 weeks out of the year. I would mix that up a bit, but yeah, in general, that's the approach.
Yeah, I would just defend myself on my periodization there. I think because I'm, and this is throughout the base phase, right? So if I was to continue that strength focus and progression going into the build or even competition phase, then I would not be adding the kind of explosive or continuing with that same progression rate that I do. This is more just, so I guess, yeah, my progression periodization is not directly aligning with yours because it's more specific to the base phase, and I guess I would really taper off the strength phase, the kind of explosive stuff as we get into the more competition phase. I mean, the other point on kind of exercise specifics is that if there was the athlete had a specific limitation or need, so for example, if they were their abductors were prone to cramping or something like that, then I would be adding that sort of work more later in the phase, and also that's when we maybe would change the rep duration rep ranges there, and maybe have a bit more of a kind of muscular endurance type focus there.
Yeah,
as well.
Go on.
I was going to say, just to follow up, I mean, if it's on, just to follow up on what you said about core work as well. Yeah, I think when you're doing the heavy compound unilateral lifting, you're getting quite a good core stimulus anyway. So
yeah,
I'm a bit reluctant to add loads of core work in, just purely because most athletes are on a quite a tight time budget. And so, yeah, it's always a secondary focus for me. But some posterior train work is obviously good, and trying to work along all the planes, but more from a kind of prehab perspective. And yeah, as I said, I'd always prioritize those general strength exercises. And if we've got time for a bit more core work, then it's easy to add in there. And I think also with core work, people think they need to go to the gym for 45 minutes and sit on an exercise ball or whatever. But actually, it's easy to just add 5-10 minutes here and there of core work in and around sessions as kind of activation. It's a bit of pre-pull, a bit of post-run kind of work, and it doesn't need to be such a long and kind of time-taxing process there.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. And I think especially the type of core strength that you get naturally from a lot of the compound lifts is more, or it's, you get most of your anti-extension type core work that way. And maybe the parts that you get less of would be, or the types of core work that you get less of is the anti-rotation and anti-lateral flexion. Mm. So I would be more keen on making sure that to put in one exercise of each of those once per week. So that might be once a week doing a couple sets of a pallof press, which is a great anti-rotation exercise, and once a week you might do suitcase carry, which is a great anti-lateral flexion exercise. But things like, you know, crunches or planks, I actually like planks, but yeah, I don't think they're necessary if you're doing things like you're doing squats, you're doing deadlifts, because you do get that same type of core strength from those compound lifts as well.
And what about mobility work? Are you adding a bit of that in as well?
That, not as a general rule of thumb. That would be in cases where there is a specific limitation that we have clearly identified in terms of mobility. Mm-hmm. It might be somebody has really stiff ankles and it's really holding them back in swimming. If somebody's doing kicking in the pool and they're going backwards, then maybe we would add some ankle mobility. But yeah, mobility, just like stretching, is something that I would only add for specifically identified needs and reasons. It's not something that I think has as much value as a general, you know, blanket approach, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I agree. It's interesting you said about the ankle joint there, because this is one thing where triathlon, it's quite a difficult task, right? Because running economy is generally considered to be improved with a stiffer ankle, and yet in the pool we need that ankle mobility there for the kick. So, I mean, how I approach it is that I try not to develop the kick at all, really, in the swim, in terms of trying to progress it, because I think you can get quite far, as we've talked about in the swim specific episode, in the pool with more of an arm driven stroke within triathlon, or just a 2-beat kick. But obviously, we don't want it to be having a negative impact in the stroke. But yet, I mean, we want to basically kind of play around with that balance in making sure that we're keeping the ankle stiff enough to run and ride well, and just getting that kind of minimal mobility there that we need in order to kick. Because, yeah, it's also, I've had athletes with more hypermobility around the ankle, and I think I've not seen any evidence or really looked into it, but they've always been very high risk in terms of injury. So it's it's difficult. It's a difficult one to play with. Have you had any experience there?
I don't have anybody right now, just to get to the point on the ankle specifically. I don't have anybody right now, or haven't had in the last year or so, actually doing it. So it has happened throughout in my coaching life, let's say, but it's not something that happens very regularly. So it was just one example of it really needs to be a specific need, and that some athletes have for me to prescribe something like that. And the same thing, another example would be shoulder mobility. I think some swim is often where mobility limitations really force you to maybe make an intervention. So some athletes might have really stiff shoulders, and then I might prescribe some shoulder mobility. I have one athlete who is doing some general mobility for swimming, but he has that through a local swim coach. So I don't actually prescribe the exercises there. But that makes sense to me when you have somebody on deck that has seen your limitations and you can get exercises for that. And sorry, remind me, what was your question again?
If you've had any experience with athletes who ram the ankle joint and I think you did answer it.
Okay.
Right?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. It was just the ankle. Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, I agree as well with the shoulder mobility. I think even I'd go a step further and say that almost everyone's going to benefit from some shoulder mobility work, especially swimmers, right? Especially triathletes, right? If you look at swimmers, their shoulder mobility is so extreme, and that's usually why they can have such an effective kind of arm action and pull catch and all this stuff, where triathletes are really limited there, and it does have a big impact on their efficiency in the water. The other kind of big limitation within triathlon is on the TT bike, right? And we're trying to hold these aggressive positions for an Ironman, or, you know, we're out there for 4, 5, 6, 7 hours sometimes. And being able to be comfortable and holding that position requires quite extreme mobility. So I like to make sure that, around the hips, the neck, the shoulders, again, we have enough range of movement there to get into and be comfortable in those positions.
Yeah.
Do you do anything specific there?
Again, only if there is an identified need. So that might be from an athlete has gone to a bike fitter and they identify that, well, this athlete is really restricted in their mobility, and then we do something about it. But otherwise, no. No, not really. Can't say I do. One related to mobility in general, like this, what about things like yoga? Do you ever prescribe that, or do you have athletes that do that ask for yoga to be added to the program, or even things like Pilates, more on a core strength, core stability? Yeah, in that area.
Yeah, it's an interesting one. I mean, I do think sometimes it can cause more harm than good, really. You know, as we talked about around having some stiff joints, it kind of help with economy, and actually having excessive mobility can be an injury risk there. But and especially if they've not got a specific need around the TT bike or something, I think I'll just go back to what I said about shoulder mobility. Other than that, I think we're spending a lot of time really improving flexibility is not necessarily going to be a good thing. I think Pilates maybe, again, has a bit more of a place, but it's not something I'm really prescribing. It's more if an athlete really feels like they enjoy it, and it's more of a social thing, which can definitely be a positive, and then I'm not kind of going to kick up too much of a fuss, but it's not something that I'm going to actively prescribe. I'd rather that we spent as much time swim, bike, and run, get the gym stuff, strength and mobility stuff in as efficiently and as in as kind of short a time as possible. And I don't think that Pilates and yoga is a very efficient use of time. Yeah.
Do you agree? I'm 100% on the same page. That's exactly how I agree with them.
What about, if someone doesn't have access to a gym, for example? Do you have any tips there?
Yeah, I think the whole pandemic was a good trigger to get a bit more informed and educated in how to deal with that kind of situation. So I think there are a few pieces of equipment that can go a really long way to have that you can have in your home, even if it's a smaller apartment, and that can help you do a lot of really good stuff. So I think an adjustable kettlebell is a really good one, which I have one, for example, that goes from, it's actually in pounds. So I think it goes from 10 pounds or maybe even 5 pounds up to 40 pounds. And so you can just remove plates. It has 8 plates. So it's the increments are quite tight, which means that you can adjust it up to a certain level, of course, quite well to do different sorts of exercises with a kettlebell, which of course it doesn't allow you to do like the really proper heavy lifting, but still it allows you to have a bit more flexibility in applying weights to different exercises. So an adjustable kettlebell, I think, is a great tool to have at home. A door anchor, which is a thing that you can basically place. You put it in a door, you close in the door opening, you close the door and you put it on the right side, or you lock the door. And then to the door anchor, you can then attach. And this is something that you can get for really cheap. It's probably something like 20 to 30 euros or dollars on Amazon or something like that. Not an expensive tool. And then to that, you can attach elastic bands, which allows you to do a lot of different exercises, whether it be a pallet press that I mentioned earlier. I've used it a lot for Nordic hamstring curls for the hamstrings that are bothering me, of course, as you might expect, and a bunch of other exercises where you might benefit from having elastic bands. And you can do a lot with elastic bands. So, of course, getting a couple of different ones of different strengths, both the bigger, longer ones of different strengths, but also the small mini bands, I think can be quite useful for certain exercises. So those tools, if you can get those adjustable kettlebell, door anchor, and elastic bands, that can, yeah, that's already a really, really, really good start, I think. And also maybe one thing that I would as well is a simple step that allows you to do quite a lot of good exercises as well. Things like, you know, heel raises and a bunch of other exercises that I prescribe regularly, but that doesn't take a lot of time. Some light plyometric work, doing some drop jumps, drop and stick, those sorts of things. So a step is something that I'm a fan of, and you can get those that are, again, you can adjust the height of the step, which for plyometrics especially is really, really useful. So yeah, I think you can get around it. I think that there's, especially if you look at the research, the high weight, low rep type of strength training seems to be very beneficial for, at least for running and cycling. And you can't really get around that at home. There's just no way to achieve that. But still, if the main, even more important than that, is just staying healthy. And I definitely think that if you have a limitation that you get injured if you don't do strength training, most athletes will be able to achieve whatever strength training that is required for them to stay healthy in a home-based setup by using these kinds of pieces of equipment and adjusting some exercises for that. So yeah, that's how I view it a bit. It's better to go to the gym or having a like well-equipped home gym if you can. But yeah, if you can do a lot of things still with simple tools that you can have in an apartment.
Yeah, no, some good tools there. I mean, I would actually say that I have seen elite athletes using even more not specific stuff they've even bought, just stuff around the house. Kind of, I did a training camp in Kenya, and people were just picking up kind of farmland equipment and that sort of stuff, and really getting super creative with anything that's not even purpose built for gym work. And I know you said that it's more difficult to get the high weight kind of low rep type stuff, but what you can do is if you've got a partner who weighs you know, well, depending on how much they weigh, you can put them on your back, or if you've got a child lying around, you can pick them up. It's a good fun for everyone. I've seen people do that, lunging, back squats, depending on the weight of the fellow family member that you're picking up. So yeah, even getting a backpack, loading it up with books, if you just want a kind of more minimal stuff, there's all sorts of stuff you can do and get creative with getting some weight.
Yeah. Those are great points. And in a home-based setup, I would also be lean more towards doing unilateral stuff because then the relative loading is higher. So doing things like Bulgarian split squats instead of standard back squat, then you would get relatively more loading without having as much weight. So that's another thing that can be used. I think we 100%. Should move on because we have taken a lot of time on this. So let's discuss nutrition, and that might be a good time to talk about our sponsor, Precision Fuel and Hydration. They are back for 2026, which we're very happy about. They, of course, as you know, produce electrolytes and carbohydrate products, gels, sports drinks. And, well, they have some of the best products in the business, really. I think they're really tasty. Great texture of the gels. That's one of the things that I really like about them. They have a great texture. They're mildly sweetened, but not too sweet. So you can tolerate them really well, even for something long like an Ironman, in my experience, which with some other gels I've found to be more difficult. So Precision Fuel Hydration, do you want to give them one compliment, Jack, to get your input as well before we give the discount code?
One thing I think is actually, obviously all their products kind of in terms of their nutrition is amazing, but you know, their bottles, there's not many other brands that have a 1 liter bottle, right?
Yeah.
It still fits perfectly into a normal bidon bike cage. So yeah, they really just think about everything. There's no stone left unturned when it comes to precision and what they're doing.
Yeah, I always use those bottles, and really, even if I didn't have them, now since I've used them, I would get out of my way to find 1 liter bottles because it just makes the logistics of a race so much easier. Yeah, listeners, you can get 15% off your first order of 2026 by using the code TTS2026 on precisionfuelandhydration.com. All the information is in the episode description, because if I got anything wrong, because this is the first new sponsor read of the year, there's always a chance that I got something wrong here. But check out the episode description. I'll make sure to have the correct information there. So let's move on to nutrition. And I think we can start with two broad categories, which is nutrition in training and nutrition in daily life. We don't want to just discuss everything and anything and everything to do with nutrition, but really if there are any differences in how you approach things during the base training phase compared to in season, in your racing season. So if we start with in training, how do you see that, Jack? Are there any differences in how you would approach nutrition in the base training phase compared to in season?
I mean, I would even, should we not start as well and kind of look at the yearly periodization of total, because I guess total nutrition intake, would that not include in and out kind of as a both?
In and out of training, you mean? Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I'm just talking about what's the focus in the base phase in terms of how much kind of carbohydrate we're taking in, right? And for me, it depends on the goals of the athlete, but typically elite athletes will put on a bit of weight for the base phase, right? And they're going to be prioritizing getting the training in, fueling and recovering from it. And it's always better to be a bit more on the safe side in terms of overfueling. So they might put on a little bit of weight. And then as we get closer to the competition season, they might focus a little bit more on losing a little bit in order to get down to so-called race weight. That's kind of typically how an elite athlete would approach the year. Obviously, there's variation there, and a lot of athletes don't really change, because if the training load is going to increase in the base phase, even through kind of your best intentions, it's sometimes hard to gain weight when your training load is so high. But that being said, some athletes, especially maybe more amateur athletes, would be, you know, recognize that losing some weight is going to help when it comes to race season, to race day. So in that case, if we want to be focusing on weight loss, then it's better to do it over a longer period rather than an aggressive kind of weight loss strategy. So in that scenario, then actually the base phase might be when we would focus on slightly less food or less kind of intake in terms of shifting that caloric balance. And so we can be a bit more careful and slow with that weight loss and that progression. So, yeah, I mean, do you have any follow-up or kind of differing opinions there on those kind of bigger...
Not really a differing opinion. I think as a coach, I don't really prescribe an elite athlete to, you know, lose weight when you approach racing, like those 1 to 2 kilo, maybe 2 to 4 pound changes over a year. It's not something that I get into, because I think it's like you're working at the margins, and it's also a bit, you're working a bit on a knife's edge almost if you're already very lean and then you want to lose another 1 to 2 kilos in race season. So that I think is a scenario where maybe the athlete has their own experience, and then I would be fine with letting them handle that, or working with a dietitian who's used to working with that level of athlete would be what I would do. But yeah, with amateurs, that's more the perspective that where as a coach can be a bit more, I guess, involved, because and I'm not talking about amateurs that are already super lean, but amateurs that know that they have weight to lose and or want that they want to lose, well, that they actually objectively have some weight to lose, so not just some people want to lose more weight than they should. So that's always a discussion to have. But if that is the case, that I agree that there is some weight to lose, then what you said there about you want to do it over a long time, do it slowly, that is the approach that I would take. So, and that means that you would start in the base training phase to try to establish a small caloric deficit. And I mean, usually about 300 kilocalories per day is a good place to start. And I think I would say that the general advice that you see is about 300 to a bit higher potentially, but I would try to err on the side of kind of not going too much higher than 300 or 400 at most. So yeah, that's basically that's not something that I would necessarily want to start with an amateur. If an amateur athlete starts working with me and we're 6 or 8 weeks out from their A race of the year, which is not necessarily the ideal time to start anyway, but it's better than not starting at all with a coach. But at that time, I would never want to start with introducing a caloric deficit as well. Like that's just, you can maybe maintain one if you've already started a caloric deficit in the base training phase. I've seen that work successfully, but I wouldn't introduce a caloric deficit at that time if it hadn't been established already, and we can see that the athlete can manage the training load and the caloric deficit at the same time. So I think that's the only thing that I consider different in the, or what, yeah, I think it's basically the only thing that is different in the day-to-day nutrition between the base training phase and the in-season phase, is that the base training phase is, if you have weight to lose, for me, a better time to introduce a caloric deficit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. I mean, for me, if the base phase, if we're increasing volume in the base phase, then quite often, sometimes the intake doesn't need to change, you know what I mean? It's just like,
you can introduce the deficit by increasing volume, but not changing the...
Yeah. But I also think that it's easy to say on paper, right? We want a 300 calorie deficit, but it's sometimes, practically speaking, it's kind of hard to implement. I mean, what do you have any practical recommendations on how that kind of a deficit should be managed throughout the day and around sessions and life?
Yeah, I wouldn't change what you're doing in any session. So if you're, whatever you're used to taking in sessions, in certain types of sessions, intense sessions, long sessions, etc., keep doing that and change what you're taking in outside of sessions, and mainly farther away from sessions. So for example, let's say you train in the morning, then you might have a small breakfast before your session. Then I would maintain that breakfast, maintain whatever you do in the session, and even what you're having right after the session, which might be a second breakfast of sorts. But then what you do later on in the day is what I would modify farther away from training. And of course, this gets a bit more complicated when you're training twice a day or three times a day. But But then, generally speaking, it would tend to be dinner that is reduced, and maybe to some extent dinner, and maybe taking a little bit here and there from some snacks as well, even from lunch potentially. So yeah, that's a bit the approach. Don't change what you do in sessions. Don't change what you do immediately before, especially the breakfast. I think I would mainly maintain, because that's when you've had the overnight fast. You need to kind of start to get some sugar in you, or get some food in you, get some energy in you, but to be ready for the session, you want to eat something there, and I don't think that you want to skimp on that really. So it would be those other meals, dinner especially, to some extent lunch and the snacks that I would try to take away a bit from if there's somebody that needs to reduce. But look, I'm not a dietitian. The best thing would always be to work with a dietitian on something like this. So these are more general tips than saying that, yeah, I'm not an expert on this. I want to make that clear. But that's how I've done it. And athletes can make it work if they're well-educated themselves, but it's always better to work with a dietitian if you have a chance to do that.
Yeah, no, I would kind of agree and echo what you said. I'm also not an expert here, but I think I would maybe put more of an emphasis on the either high duration or high intensity sessions as well. Sometimes if it's just a short, easy recovery type session, zone wants to kind of, you know, then I don't think fueling needs to be prioritized to quite that same kind of level. And I think just practically speaking, a lot of people, the dinner, the evening meal is such a social kind of activity. It's hard to just suddenly cut things out of there, right? So it is really difficult and to just suddenly say, I'm going to eat less here and there. So this is where maybe working with a dietitian or a nutritionist can really help with those sorts of things. But I think I always just like the term fuel the work, right? So it's always looking ahead to what you have coming up. If you have a big day the following day, you know, you've got a long ride or something, then that's when you want to make sure that the day before you're being a little bit more on it with what you're eating, and you don't have to, and you don't want to be cutting calories then. And then the opposite is true as well, right? So I think that's I have some athletes who it's you need a bit of a kind of something to look forward to, right? They really enjoy having that kind of sweet treat or whatever. But if you can think about periodizing it throughout the week, then it gives you the best of both worlds. You still are able to let yourself have the extra, but you know that it's going in at a time when your body's going to use it.
Yeah.
Do you, I mean, you said about obviously the overnight fast with the breakfast. Do you play around at all with fasting or kind of carbohydrate periodization around any other sessions or training?
No,
with other athletes?
I have in the past. I don't see the value for athletes, potentially for non-athletes, but definitely not for athletes. I discourage any other fasting than just the normal fast when you're sleeping, which most people do. And the things like, you know, intentionally training on low glycogen and that sort of thing, I also discourage. That's something that I have played around with quite a lot in the past, but I think there's more evidence now that it used to be quite a hot topic, and then there were some interesting early findings, I think, in the research, but I think that it's kind of stagnated and the research isn't looking so positive now for that. But more importantly, anecdotally, I haven't really found that to be very helpful, but in some cases it can be quite harmful. So that's not something that I do. Do you do that?
No, I think the thing I would want to mention there is that you can still be well-fueled, start this training fueled, and go out and fuel without taking 120 grams of carbs per hour, you know?
Yeah.
So I think it's going, not fasting is also not taking as much carbs as possible. And because I think that's also can be a problem. And also, I think that if we are looking to lose weight, then it's sometimes having a kind of more moderate approach to fielding training is better rather than going kind of all out, and sometimes even maybe more on the low carb side sometimes. And it's not really through the goal of that metabolic response or having that kind of increase in, you know, fat oxidation or whatever that we may be looking to have when we're fasting. It's more just that if we're trying to be at a calorie deficit, then sometimes slightly less during some sessions is an easier way to do that. So then, as I said earlier, that you can still have that sociable meal later in the day that you know is a non-negotiable for you.
Yeah, my default advice for age groupers is not to fuel with 120 grams an hour. I think that's something that makes sense when the output is very high. So it makes sense for professional athletes. It makes sense for some age groupers that are really, really strong and are pushing high power, running fast paces, etc. But for most, for the typical age group athlete, I just don't think that makes sense compared to the more, the traditional about 90 grams an hour as a kind of racing or high intensity fueling strategy. And then you would obviously scale that down when you're doing some lower intensity stuff, even if it's long. So, you know, a typical athlete that I coach might be doing 90 grams an hour in their racing and in their specific workouts. And if they have a longer workout with a bunch of race intensity, but if they have a short intense workout, then they might not need to take that amount because it's so short. A 1 hour VO2 workout might be 60 to 90 grams an hour. And a longer low intensity workout might also be around that 40 to 60 grams an hour. So it's definitely not something that I think everybody should be doing. I think that the high carb stuff, it really works, but it's a perfect example of something that you can't just take from what are the pros doing and apply it and expect it to work equally well for age groupers. It's not to say that if you train your gut to tolerate that it will necessarily do any harm other than you're taking in, you know, an unnecessary amount of carbohydrate and I would be more concerned about dental health almost than anything else. But I just don't think it adds value. I just don't think it adds performance unless you are a pretty high output athlete in terms of your powers and paces that you're pushing.
I agree. I think what would you do? I mean, I have had some athletes that we're really looking to squeeze kind of that last little bit out, and there's, you know, maybe there's been a bit of a plateau. Then doing some kind of slightly lower carb ride, or maybe reducing carb intake towards the beginning of a long ride, so I have kind of played around with that, I guess, which I didn't mention earlier, and it's something that I would still not be completely against doing, and I still do occasionally do with some athletes. So I guess I'm probably a little bit more open to some fasted or slightly fasted lower carb rides than maybe the new there.
Yeah.
What about in terms of the fuel type in training in base phase compared to competition?
The main difference, I think, is that you don't need to be so concerned about, well, what are the products that you're going to be using on race day, because you're still far from racing. When you get close to racing, you would want to know, okay, what am I going to use on race day? And you would want to do at least your key specific sessions with those products. So, for example, if you're using Precision Fuel Hydration on race day, you might want to use that in training, or you should use that in the specific training. In the base training phase, I think that's not so important because you're still so far from racing. You definitely have more than enough time to then train with your specific race nutrition hydration strategy later on. So even things like a lot of athletes are using just, you know, table sugar and salt, mixing that in bottles and to get a cheaper alternative to sports nutrition products. that's something that I think can work quite well in this phase. Even, you know, when you go out on your long rides, more real food options, but still, you still run into the issue of if you want to fuel with 60 grams an hour, let's say, or 60 to 90 grams an hour, it's a lot of bananas you have to eat. So it would be more like, okay, you still take some kind of sugary product, but you maybe take a bit less of that, and you take a few bananas with you, and maybe a coffee break. Oh, that's another difference, I think, that when we get closer to races, that's not the time and place to have coffee breaks in your long rides. But in the base training phase, I'm all for it to have some coffee breaks in your long rides. So and that can, of course, be part of the in-training nutrition, whatever you're having for your coffee break.
Yeah, no, I agree with all that. I mean, if you're even at 60 grams, it's really hard to get in enough from just having whole foods and dried fruit. So, yeah. But I mean, I always take a pack of Oreos or something like that as well. Whereas in a competition phase, I'm really trying to dial in on exactly what I'm having on race day.
Yeah.
But yeah, you still get gut training, and you could argue maybe you get even more gut adaptation from having a variety of foods in there, because the absorption is going to be a little bit more difficult, right? And you can, if you're having more of a fruit, then maybe the fructose side of things is slightly higher, which is the side of the carbs that your gut can improve that in its absorption, right?
Yeah, that's a great point. No, I think that's, yeah, that it's a great point about actually some variety could be like training a new stimulus, and that's a new stimulus for your gut, so might help with even with your absorption of your specific race products that you're using. I guess one more thing on the day-to-day nutrition that I wanted to say is we're recording now on the 5th of January, so just past the new year. And even though there's nothing magical about the new year, it is as good a time as any to establish some new habits. So if there's something that you feel that you've been like missing out on, well, that it could apply to in training as well, I guess. But I'm thinking now more in terms of out of training. For example, if you're not having enough water throughout the day, or you're maybe not having enough vegetables or fruit throughout the day and throughout the week, or you're missing out on, you're not having enough protein in your diet, all those sorts of things, it could be just a good time to think about that, try to draw a line in the sand and establish a new habit that you try to really follow, and then it gets established over time, of course, and then so that's something I would also consider, not just in the base training phase, but in this particular time that we're in right now, having just started the new year. Is that something that you do?
Yeah, I guess. I mean, I'm always looking for kind of new things to ways to improve my diet, but yeah.
Not so much the new year doesn't change things so much for you.
No. I mean, I guess you've probably been a little bit more relaxed over the last couple of weeks. So it's more just about getting back to default, right?
Yeah.
For me. Yeah.
I mean, speaking of that, so we were meant to record this before Christmas, and it made more sense then, but hopefully this will be an evergreen episode. So let's discuss a bit how to manage things during that Christmas, New Year's period when, yeah, it is easy to be more relaxed, as you said. And actually, it might be good that we record this after the fact, because we can actually talk about, from a personal perspective, well, what is theory, but what did we actually do? Did that match up with the theory? So what is, first of all, what is your ideal vision of what it should look like, nutrition, and all of that, consumption of foods and beverages during this period, and what did you end up doing in the end?
Yeah, I mean, for me, you know, when I'm in this is difficult for me because I've obviously had a bike crash, so it's not a normal period. Usually I'm trying to consume almost as many calories as possible because if you know my output is so high, I'm a bigger guy. I'm training, you know, five hours a day or so, and so that doesn't really change over the Christmas period. If anything, it maybe is easier to do because there's more opportunities for intake. But yeah, I mean, practically speaking, it's hard to reflect because my training load was down, but I probably just kept eating as much. So yeah, but I think also you shouldn't beat yourself up, right? It's okay to let yourself slip, because I think it's still a long time to race season, and you need to kind of get these things out of your system if you want to have a few extra beers or whatever. You got to get it out of your system. I always say to my athletes that if we it's a long kind of time until the first race, and these next months coming up are when I want you to be on it and doing, you know, leaving no stone unturned. So having a couple of missed sessions or extra calories is over this period is always, yeah, is not a bad thing.
Yeah, I think that that's also my main message, is everything in moderation, including moderation. Meaning that, yeah, if you have a couple of instances or the holiday period where you're not really moderating things, then yeah, I don't think there's any harm done. And that being said, I do think there's something to be said for, and I'm not gonna be able to fully explain this well, I think, but I've heard psychologists talk about this, and even like, yeah, dietitians, nutritionists that understand also the psychology of nutrition. But I think that when you really, you know, overindulge in a way, whether it's food or sweets or alcohol or something like that, then like there's something to be said for, you know, it's Christmas, you have a lot of good food, you can eat a lot of good food, you can have a fair bit of good beverages. But at some point, having more of those chocolates is not really changing anything for you positively. And I can say this from personal experience, that because I definitely had a couple of nights when I was having so much chocolate over this period. And it just becomes something that you do on autopilot. It's your brain is no longer in control, or it's more like that whole primitive thinking system that evolution is taking charge, that, oh, there's food available, with like ultra palatable food available, like your brain is going to want to keep having that, but it's not actually increasing your enjoyment or of anything. So I think it's something to be aware of and I think especially with things like sweets and with alcohol as well. I think that's, it's not to say that it's bad or that you beat yourself up. I'm definitely not beating myself up over it. But at the same time, I know that, you know, after quite a few of those chocolates, I didn't get any joy from it more than I got from the first few, but I kept eating them. And I think that happens. So it's something that I think is worth it to be aware of, that tendency that we have, which I think is completely evolutionary.
Yeah. I mean, one thing I always think about is triathletes often have an addictive personality, right? That's why we're training so much. But which is obviously a good thing when it comes to training, but like an addictive personality means that you need to do more of the training in order to get the same kind of dopamine response, right? But then you put that same mentality when it, in front of some chocolate or some alcohol, and you're also going to go excessive with it. So as you said, it's something to be aware of, but it's really difficult. It's biology in a way, right? And yeah.
I think one other point on this topic as well is that, at least personally, I would really strongly discourage then any kind of compensation diet after, because that's like a crash diet if you put it in like more the social media terms, like a detox or something like that. It's like you said before, I think after this period, you just want to get back into your normal routine, do things normally, and don't do anything different than what you would normally do. And yeah, if you put on, which happens, a couple of kilos, then you will take a little while for that to come off, but it will come off. So I definitely don't encourage any kind of compensation diet after, or I would discourage that. I would say just get back to your normal habits and yeah, get back on that track, and nothing special after the holiday period to compensate.
Yeah, no, definitely agree there.
All right. Well, we also had testing on our agenda, but actually we've been going for a long time. So Jack, my thought here is that let's leave testing for a different episode, and then we can discuss it not just from a base training perspective, but just general testing, because that could be a whole episode in and of itself. And then we can just move on to the listener questions. What do you think about that? Does that sound good?
Perfect. Let's do it.
Yeah. So listener questions and apologies. Again, I put these questions out a few weeks ago. We were meant to record, but yeah, because of the delay in recording, I haven't put a request for questions out more recently, but we're getting quite a few questions back then, so I still have those available. So I'll ask you the first question and we can take turns. So Mark Kendall Morse asks, for athletes 60 plus with slower recovery, what are your thoughts regarding training longer every other day?
Yeah, I mean, the load is going to be higher, right? So it's almost counterintuitive, because anyone's going to need more recovery from a longer session anyway. So it's like, are you actually getting longer recovery if you're increasing the load? Do you see what I'm saying?
I see. I'm also skeptical. I can tell that you are.
So yeah, I would say that this is, if anything, I would go onto the flip side and say that if you want to manage load more easily, then you would want to spread it out over the week. And I would still, when I'm looking at recovery for more masters athletes or older athletes, then it's not just about having a day off or between sessions. It's more about recovery between intensive sessions, less frequency of intensive sessions, recovery between reps, recovery in general from just total volume and load, rather than I don't think that this idea of a session every other day is optimal. The next question here is from Vanja Somodi. Is it fine to run only sub-threshold and faster and do most of the pure aerobic sessions on the bike?
It's an interesting question. I think there are some athletes that are prone to injury based on running volume more so than intensity. And you could argue when Vanja talks about sub-threshold and faster, I interpret that as saying basically you don't do a lot of easy running, zone one, zone two, but you basically run zone three and upwards in a five-zone system. So it could be that you do two run sessions, let's say a threshold run and a VO2 run, and then the rest of, and you don't do any aerobic running, and then you do a bunch of aerobic cycling to compensate. I mean, I think there's, for very particular type of athlete that don't seem to handle running volume well, I think there's a case for trying that. I can't say that I have ever had that experience as a coach of trying this with an athlete, but I could see that it could work for a very specific type of athlete. I don't think it's for most people, though.
Yeah, I can kind of agree. I would still want to touch every kind of energy system, though, right? Maybe you'd have a bit more of a focus or emphasis towards the intensity on the run because you're getting more central volume adaptations on the bike, but you'd still want to be hitting those more peripheral kind of stimuluses on the run a little bit, maybe. That would be my take.
Yeah. Stan Dimitrov Tri asks, how much time do you devote to each intensive zone?
Well, yeah, I mean, unfortunately, it's one where it depends, doesn't it? But typically, I would say we're looking at, you know, maybe the 70 to 80%, if we just go on that kind of standard 80-20 type principle, 70 to 80% zone 1 to 2. And then in long course triathlon, you would maybe then look at having, I would say, more like 10 to 12% in the heavy intensity domain. So that would be in between, it'd be kind of zone 3. And then the final five.
Zone three and zone four, right?
Zone three and zone four, and then maybe the last 5% or so. So yeah, I guess in the context of base phase, then that would probably be about right.
It ends up, honestly, it's hard to say for the base training phase. I couldn't say off the top of my head, but over the course of a year, it ends up being something like that. I mean, the lower the volume, the higher the volume, the more that that low intensity chunk grows. So for somebody training 20 hours a week on average, it might be 90%. It might be 90%, 7%, 3%, or 98% or 85% to 90%. And for somebody training 6 to 8 hours a week, it might be more around that 70%, and then somebody in between might be 80%. So it would scale a bit based on the total volume. In my experience, or for me as a coach anyway. But generally speaking, that large chunk of zone one, zone two, and then definitely you would end up being spending a lot more time in zone three, zone four than in zone five, also because just when you do a zone five session, the total time at intensity is pretty low.
Yeah, for sure. So we have David Cornelius. What about testing in all sports and how to change testing according to the results?
Well, so that is to come in a future episode, I guess.
Yeah.
That we just established. I mean, just super quickly, in the context of base training especially, I would like to do a critical power test on the bike. So usually I would use something like 3-minute test plus a 5-minute test plus a 20-minute test, because a 20-minute test also aligns with what people are used to with a classic FTP test. But it could be 3 minutes, 5 minutes, and 12 minutes, or 3 minutes, 6 minutes, and 12 minutes, or 10 minutes. But yeah, I use now 3, 5, and 20 on the bike. On the run, I now use 200, 400, 800. I have used some different combinations in the past, but that's what I've landed on. And on the run, I usually like my athletes to do something like a park run, so a 5K or a 10K road race, and use that data to establish zones. I rarely prescribe critical speed testing on the run, although I have done that in the past, so it's not something that I don't do, but it's less on the run. I'm pretty happy with just getting one solid like road race and establish zones based on that.
Nice. Yeah, no, I agree. I probably would typically lean towards only two durations for the bike and swim, just because it's more repeatable.
Yeah,
I agree that it's the three is definitely a bit better data, but yeah.
I mean, he asked, how do you change training according to results as well? Well, I think the main thing there, like there's a lot of things we could go into, and we can go into that in the future episode. But the main thing is that, well, when you first do the testing if you do it pretty early on in the base training phase, with a critical power, critical speed test, you get to see a bit of whether the athlete is more leaning more fast twitch or slow twitch, or leaning more strong on the short intense stuff, or leaning stronger on the sort of endurance end of things. You build out that power duration or speed duration curve. And that then, if depending on the demands of the event, that can influence how you train the athlete. So if somebody is pretty bad at, they're pretty strong at the high intensity stuff, but bad at the longer stuff, then the emphasis would shift towards doing more of that, developing that endurance side more so than the high intensity stuff. So, but if somebody's bad at, for example, we talked before about how I typically like to include a couple of VO2 max blocks through the base training phase. But if somebody's really good at that high intensity and they have a strong drop off, we might not do that at all. We might just stay in the moderate and heavy domains with training.
Yeah, no, I don't have anything too much to add there.
Then we have JCO Trialonista, who asks, how do you approach progressing in two disciplines and maintaining fitness in the third one?
Yeah, good question. I mean, I don't typically like to do this too much, to be honest, with my athletes. I think it's triathlon, and I don't like to stay too far away from, I'd rather just to kind of approach you as an entire athlete rather than really put one into a maintenance mode for too long. But yeah, you'd still want to ideally hit kind of, you want to maintain a moderate amount of volume still, kind of without, I guess, taking away from the two disciplines that you're focusing on, and still adding some intensity in there. Probably what intensity that is probably depends quite a lot, but maybe some, kind of progressive type sessions where you're going through all the gears, as it were, works quite well, or even just some more tempo type stuff in that maintenance discipline, which is not going to take away too much from the two focus sports there. And yeah, I guess that's probably how I would approach that one. Do you have anything to add there?
No, not really.
So the next question is from Runstrong BCN. Is an Ironman possible for a strong runner, so he or she runs a 3:15 marathon, who has swam a max 2 kilometers so far? And if so, when is it possible?
Well, Jack, as you know, anything is possible. Yes, an Ironman is definitely possible. I mean, they don't mention anything about the bike. I would say that, well, if they never biked, then that's probably a bigger challenge than building up that 2K swim to a 3.8K swim, but absolutely it's possible. Just with the information that we have of having swum max 2K and needing to build that to a 3.8K, I don't know if that 2K was continuous or not, but, you know, that's something that can be done in just a few months. Yeah, I mean, less than that really, but to build up to an Ironman, yeah, you probably want to give yourself a solid 4 month training block at the very least. That's reasonable, but that's dependent on you having reasonable cycling base to work on. And if you don't have that, then you would probably want to give yourself something longer. But yeah, you could probably do one towards the end of 2026 if you don't have any cycling experience and your swim is where it is now. So yeah, it's possible to do that. It might be, if you don't have any cycling experience, it might be better to not do an Ironman, do some shorter triathlons first, build up. But that's not to say that it's not possible.
Yeah.
Then we have Garibaldi, IVBBB, who asks, my question is, how would you structure training if you have a zone 2 weakness in running and you can train up to 14 hours per week? And how much can you improve in a 7 month time frame?
Right, so I mean, a zone 2 weakness, I guess maybe they are implying they have more of an anaerobic kind of focused or an aerobic weakness there.
Maybe lacking endurance.
Yeah, lacking endurance. So, I mean, I would probably, first I would question how you've got to that conclusion and maybe look at doing a bit more formal testing and really trying to figure out what's going on there. But yeah, I mean, if endurance is the focus and that is a real weakness, then volume is probably going to be your first port of call with kind of trying to build that up, and then also adding some more tempo and controlled threshold work as well in there, making sure that you've got a long run. And how much can you improve in 7 months? Well, I mean, it depends on how much training you can get in, really. Can you maintain consistency over that period? And how close you are to your potential, I guess. And
yeah, that's a big one. I think the farther you are from your potential, the quicker you can improve. So
I guess that's enough for that one. So this is the last question, I believe, from Will Lastman.
I think you can just read out the first paragraph. That's basically the whole question.
Sure. Are there certain kinds of sessions that you would or would not recommend doing on a treadmill? How do you execute strides and hill sprints on a treadmill? Have you ever used or thought about the use of a manual, self-propelled / curved treadmill?
Yeah, so for the first part, certain kinds of sessions that you would or would not recommend doing on a treadmill. Yeah, so I don't prescribe these a lot. I have done them as an athlete when I've been coached with, you know, more like sprint interval training stuff where you do 30 seconds all out and then 4 or 5 minutes easy running. That sort of session where you really have, when there's no pacing and you just need to go all out, yeah, that's, I wouldn't recommend doing on the treadmill. But again, I don't really prescribe that much as a coach. So yeah, that would only apply if you do those sorts of sessions. Strides and hill sprints, I think that are better done outdoors, but they can be done on the treadmill. So, but yeah, I would prefer to do them outdoors. And yeah, if you want to do that, then just, yeah, it's more, he mentions there in the second paragraph, which is a lot longer, that he feels that the running mechanics are different to doing things like strides on the treadmill compared to outdoors. And I think that's fair. I think I agree. I still think you get something from doing them on the treadmill compared to not doing them at all. I would definitely do them on the treadmill. Like you definitely get leg turnover, which is one of the good things about doing strides. So yeah, I would do them, but I would prefer to do them outdoors. But other types of sessions, what kinds of sessions do we have? We have VO2 sessions, threshold, tempo. I would do all of them on the treadmill. But it's not to say that they're better, but they're all doable on the treadmill very, very easily if you have a decent treadmill. And then the final part of the question, have you ever thought of using the self-propelled curb treadmill? I haven't used it. I know a lot of people, or some people, really like it. So I'm sure it's very good. All of the research that exists, I shouldn't say all, but I think most of the research that exists are good commercial, normal treadmills. So, and we have lots of studies on running intervals and so on, that where runners have improved a lot on those treadmills. So I don't think it's necessarily that you would massively have a massive difference between those 2,000 treadmills. We know that classic treadmills work, so to say. But yeah, I don't know. I think that you would just have to try the curved treadmill and see how you feel about it and how it works for you. I think that I personally, we talked about this on a previous episode, that I like to use the treadmill. And one of the things I like about the treadmill, which I think is similar to what a lot of people like about erg mode on the bike, is that you just set the pace, set the power, and then you just run and you don't have to think about things. You just have to stay on the treadmill. It almost takes the mental effort out of the equation in a way. And you can really just use all of your effort on the physical effort rather than the mental effort. So and that's something that I find appealing about a classic treadmill compared to a self-propelled treadmill, even though maybe mechanically it's not as optimal and maybe it is a bit, you know, it is cheating in a way. Like it's not quite the same. But that being said, there are also studies showing that treadmill pace, a calibrated treadmill pace, really correlates very well with outdoor running. The whole 1% grade when you run the treadmill isn't even really borne out in the majority of the research. So yeah, those are some thoughts there. Do you have anything to add to that?
Yeah, I mean, I would just go back to the strides. I would definitely avoid using the treadmill. I think the goal of strides is to improve biomechanics, right? Mainly, and I think the biomechanics are definitely different when you got the belt moving underneath you. But I would echo what you said on everything else there.
But would you not do strides if you live in a climate where you're actually forced to run on a treadmill? Like there's ice and snow all year round and the athlete can't actually run outdoors. Would you just skip them completely, or would you still do a poor man's version of them on the treadmill?
No, I mean, yeah, it's better than nothing. But I mean, surely you can find a car park or something, or I don't know. So there's somewhere that
I need to take
maybe that's my ignorance.
I need to take you to Finland.
okay. You don't have like, I don't know.
No, I mean,
field? Can you not run on like? Surely, just if it's just snow, like you can do strides on snow, right? If it's like
I think you can. You can always find a solution, I think, or almost always, or at least in Finland, you can. There are only a few days maybe when you have new snow but you need to do. It's more about as well if you need to do it before work. It's dark and it's icy. It's dangerous. Yeah. So if you have the whole day and you can do it when it's a bit warmer, you have light, then it
can work. Of course. Yeah, I also, those self-propelled treadmills, I've tried a couple runs on them, but yeah, I don't have any strong opinion, really. I think, if you enjoy them, then go for it. If you feel like they're going to be a bit more protective in terms of injury risk as well, then maybe that would be a reason to use them. But you don't have the intensity control, which I think is one of the big reasons, as we've talked about in the past, for using a treadmill.
Coming back to that whole climate question, and I would actually add one aspect, which is temperature. And I know that there's actually right now, as we're recording, there's a cold snap in Northern Europe. And I read that in Finland, for example, there, even in Southern Finland, it's going to be really cold. Like, we're talking minus 10 and colder. I think I read even in the southern parts of the country. So really cold. Doing things like strides or any kind of intense workout in that cold, even if you have bare ground or like well maintained roads where you don't have that, there's no risk of falling, but just the cold itself can be a bit of a risk for muscle strains. So at least personally, I found that to be the case when running in cold temperatures, that my creaky hamstrings are more prone to not enjoying that very much. So that's another consideration, another reason that's not just related to the strides, but the sessions in general, where maybe there is a tick in the advantage box for treadmills compared to outdoor running in the winter when you have cold snaps and the temperature gets really cold. But yeah, I think people are a bit individual there. Personally, I'm quite fine doing fast running down to like minus 5 or so. That's usually okay. But when it gets colder than that, I tend to be a bit reluctant to do it.
Yeah, no, that's a really good point. It doesn't matter how good the mechanics are on the treadmill. If you're going to get injured going outside, you definitely want to avoid that.
Yeah. Well, I think that wraps it up for today. This was a bit of a longer episode, and we didn't even get to the testing part, but that's good. We have a topic for a future one. So yeah, thank you everybody for tuning in to this series, and thank you, Jack, for co-hosting. Hope you enjoyed.
Yeah, thanks a lot for having me. I hope the listeners enjoyed also.
And listeners, you can find the detailed show notes on scientifictriathlon.com/base5. And of course, if you're very new to the podcast, check out the previous episodes that we've already done in this series about swimming, cycling, running, and the introductory episodes. Also, if you're interested in coaching, training plans, consultations, anything that can help you improve your triathlon performance, check out our scientifictriathlon.com, the information we have there about our services. And if you want to work with a coach like Jack or myself or any of the other great coaches we have, then yeah, we have all of the information there. And you can ask me for more information on michael@scientifictriathlon.com. And we'll see you in the next episode, which I don't know at the moment what it will be, but we'll try to be quite consistent with a weekly episode this year on the podcast. So stay tuned for that. And in the meantime, thank you as always for listening. Keep training smart and keep loving triathlon.